Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. On November 8th, 2018, a fast-moving fire ravaged Paradise, a community of 27,000 people nestled in the foothills of California's Sierra Nevada mountains. The deadly fire forced thousands of residents to flee, burned more than 150,000 acres, and leveled more than 18,000 buildings. It took 17 days for the blaze to be brought under control completely. It was the deadliest and most destructive fire in California's history. In their new book, Fire in Paradise, an American Tragedy, today's guests, journalist Alistair G. and Danny Anguiano, provide a moving account of people who lived in the community, the history of Paradise, victims' lawsuits filed against the utility giant Pacific Gas and Electric, or PG&E, the history of wildfires, and the links between their proliferation and climate change. Alistair G. is an award-winning journalist and editor of special series at The Guardian. Alistair works on issues including plastic inequality and homelessness. Hi, Alistair. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Danny Anguiano writes for The Guardian and was formerly a reporter for the Chico Enterprise Record. Chico is just down the road from Paradise in California. Hi, Danny. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Thank you. We're glad to be here.
It's great to have both of you. Well, Danny, I want to start off with you because you were a reporter at Chico Enterprise Record, which is just down the road from Paradise. You were a reporter there for several years, so this is a very personal story for you.
That's right. I was a reporter at the local newspaper there for about 3 years, so Paradise was a community that I was very familiar with, both for that reason and also because I grew up in Chico. I spent 10 years there. My family's lived there for a long time. So I knew this community quite well. You know, my brother-in-law was a police officer there. I had family who lived there. And when the fire started that day, I immediately started getting texts from, you know, friends and family members who were really worried about how quickly this fire was moving. They were texting me things like, please pray for my town. I don't know if my home is safe. So from the get-go, it was very personal.
Tell us a little bit about this community before we dive in and talk about the fire. As you both write, community members spend days among a gorgeous profusion of pines and oaks and wildflowers. It's the trees and the sun and the sky. And for people who aren't familiar with the area, Paradise is about 150 miles northeast of San Francisco. So, Danny, tell us just a little bit about the community.
Sure.
Paradise.
Danny, why don't you go first?
Yeah, sure. So Paradise was, you know, not the California of San Francisco or Los Angeles. It was a much smaller rural community. The largest nearby city is Sacramento. And to give you a kind of a glimpse of Paradise, it helps to describe it, I think. So if you drive up from the Sacramento Valley into the Sierra Nevada foothills, as you drive up, you'll see these beautiful views of flooded rice fields and this tiny little mountain range. And then once you drive up about 15 minutes or so, that's when you kind of find yourself just under the trees. And you are in this little tiny settlement, this little suburban town in the trees, or at least you were. And it was, you know, a small suburban town where neighbors were close and people lived there, both because it was naturally beautiful and because it was very affordable. It was the sort of place where, you know, a senior knew their retirement income would last, and where people who couldn't afford to live in other more expensive parts of the state could build a home for themselves. And people also loved it because it was so nestled in nature. They could easily find a trail to hike or go camping or run into a swimming hole.
What would you add, Alistair? In your book, you both write that, as Danny said, it's much more affordable. In a place like San Francisco, a two-bedroom goes for more than $1.3 million. Just 3 hours away in Paradise, a two-bedroom is about $200,000.
Yeah, Danny described it really well. This was also a place, as you mentioned, Rose, with a higher percentage of people, for instance, who had a disability than in the rest of California. There were lots of seniors there. You know, this skewed lower income as well. For all the reasons Danny mentioned, this was an affordable place. It's a place, actually, that has its roots, like so many towns in the Sierra, in the gold rush. Paradise came into existence in the late 19th century and only incorporated as a town, actually, in the late 1970s. But it was known as Paradise because people recognized that this was a naturally stunning area. And it was a place where you could have your own little patch of California, unlike, as you said, somewhere like San Francisco, which is increasingly unaffordable.
Yeah, I did not realize these numbers. You write that in 2018, a quarter of the population was age 65 and older. I did read about that, but about 25% were disabled, more than double the rate in California at large.
Yeah, it was something that I actually wasn't aware of either. You know, living in Chico, we talked about Paradise being, you know, kind of a retirement community, a community with a lot of older people, but it wasn't until Alistair and I began the research for this book that we saw just how true that was. And it was for that reason that, you know, a town like Paradise that is so, was always so at risk for fires, it was just another component that it had to worry about. Would elderly people, many of whom lived alone, some of whom didn't have cars, would they be able to get out during a fire? I think that was a question that was on a lot of people's minds.
Right. And so many stories were written about what happened to various people, if they were alone, if they had a disability. And given that so many stories have been written about this, why did you both decide to really dive in and write an entire book about what happened in Paradise? Danny, what did you set out to accomplish?
Alistair and I covered the fire from the beginning. I was there fairly soon after it started. And it was quite clear to me that this community that I knew and loved was never going to be the same. And so from there, I think we both just felt a real dedication to follow the story, to continue reporting on what was happening even after the news cameras left. You know, as you mentioned, there were some pretty shocking, dramatic stories that came out of this. One that comes to mind is a nurse I spoke with who learned about the fire, and her and her colleagues at the hospital made the decision to evacuate and clear out the hospital. So within, you know, less than an hour, they evacuated 67 patients without ambulances. They didn't have ambulances, so they put patients in cars and got them out of there. And when it was finally her chance to leave and the hospital was finally clear, the roads outside were so crowded that there was no hope of getting out. Things were already burning all around her. Things at the hospital were catching on fire that she had to walk out on foot. And so, you know, there are all these stories like that from the time of the fire. But going on, I think Alistair and I both realized that there were so many stories we still needed to hear and that the world still needed to hear. And so I think that was important to both of us. And for me, I really wanted to make sure that this town that I knew and loved, you know, wasn't forgotten, that people understood what had happened there.
Mm. Alistair, what would you add?
I think that this was a fire of superlatives. As you mentioned at the beginning, this was California's deadliest ever recorded wildfire. It's the deadliest in the U.S. in 100 years. Not only that, but this fire behaved in ways that fire scientists did not think were possible. The fire sparked at about 6:30 a.m. in the morning on November 8, 2018. And the speed at which it then progressed towards Paradise, a town several miles away, was faster than scientists actually thought was possible. At one point, it was consuming. The fire was eating almost 400 football fields worth of vegetation a minute. And so this fire steamrolled towards this town, causing destruction, I think, that is unparalleled. When we think of American towns being destroyed, we have to think back to, I don't know, Pearl Harbor or something, the Second World War, and even, you know, that wasn't an entire town. It's really, there's so little parallel in the modern era for what happened to Paradise, which was really total devastation. I think what's fascinating about Paradise is that people kept telling us, we knew a fire was going to come. Like in so much of the American West and in so much of California, we know that fires are a fact of life. We recognize that our ecosystem has evolved, in fact, to require fire. There are certain trees, conifers, for instance, that can only propagate themselves, in fact, when fire opens up their seed cones. But what we've seen in the last decade or two is fires that first responders say they've never seen before. And speaking to the emergency planners in Paradise in particular, they told us, look, we knew a fire was going to come. We just never expected a fire to be this bad, to be this apocalyptic. And so Paradise was really, it was a fire of superlatives, and it was superlatives that no one could have predicted.
When you spoke with a number of officials, people who study these issues, what did you learn about why this became the deadliest fire in California's history? Alistair, what really stood out for you?
I think there were a lot of factors going on here. I think that one of the major background factors to all of the fires in California is climate change. California has had some of its hottest ever years in the last decade or so. The Sierra snowpack is receding earlier and is smaller than it has been historically. It's simply a drier landscape. It's primed for fire in a way that it wasn't before. The way that we have suppressed fire as well, we've been so effective at putting out wildfires in the past century or so. We've got Cal Fire, which is amazing, but we've been so good at putting out fires that actually forests are denser and filled with tangled underbrush than they have been before, because previously fires that historically were never put out because there were no Euro-Americans living here, these fires were historically not put out, and so they would burn out this tangled undergrowth. But now, because we're so good at putting out fires, the forests are denser than they would have been. And then you add to that PG&E's power lines, which are a factor in so many of the fires in recent years. PG&E has in fact said that it's power lines were responsible for thousands of fires in just a several-year period in the late 2010s. And so you have this aging PG&E power line on a hill a few miles east of Paradise, and this power line was, by PG&E's own admission, several decades past its useful life and should have been replaced. And so you had a very fateful power outage on the morning of November 8th. You add in climate change, you add in the state of California's wilderness, and it became the perfect fire.
Danny, what would you add?
I think, you know, just like Alistair said, all of those factors, and the other big one is the wind. The wind that the day leading up to the fire, the evening leading up to the fire, was so, so strong. And due to Paradise's, you know, unique geography situated on this ridge, it really could get battered by winds. I remember an officer that I interviewed told me about how a few years before they had taken to calling the town Windopolis when things got really, really windy, but could also be very deadly. A few years before the fire, wind brought down a tree limb on a vehicle and ended up, you know, killing a woman. And so going into this, the winds in the area near Paradise were very, very strong. And, you know, ultimately, a key factor in what caused that PG&E equipment to fail.
Today, we are talking about the devastating fire that happened in Paradise. We're speaking with journalists Alistair G. and Danny Anguiano about their new book, Fire in Paradise, An American Tragedy. On November 8th, 2018, a community of 27,000 was swallowed by the ferocious fire. It razed virtually every home, tragically killed at least 85 people, and displaced thousands. If you have any questions for our guests today, Alistair G. and Danny Anguiano, about what they learned about Paradise, and really, what lessons can we learn from this? We've done so many shows about fires in the West, and a lot of people say that some of this is really our new normal, and we have to figure out how to adapt to this, how to change certain things. Obviously, the climate crisis is a major factor. So if you have any questions or comments, You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Let's talk a little bit about preparation. Now that this issue is getting so much attention and places that have not been affected before, like in the middle of Santa Rosa, for example, being affected by fires, a lot of people are talking about preparation and evacuation. You write that Paradise actually had a really good, decent evacuation plan in place. The latest version in 2017 split the city into 14 evacuation zones. Evacuations would proceed based on which areas were affected. During a disaster, cars would be permitted to use both lanes on certain roads to flee, and Paradise sent out Know Your Zone mailers to residents. Danny, talk about the preparation plan and how did it unfold?
Sure. So given the constant risk Paradise faced when it came to fire, that it was a town that was actually quite prepared. You know, as you mentioned, with all of those things, it had divided the town into zones. It had an emergency alert system where people who, you know, signed up for the county alerts could be warned of fire. And it had also staged evacuation drills. So it was a town that knew that it was going to face a deadly fire and had, you know, gone to great lengths to prepare for that, both through those measures and through different vegetation management around projects around town. But ultimately, what we saw that day is that the fire that started, you know, a few miles outside of Paradise, it moved so quickly, driven by the wind, that it reached town much sooner than anyone thought was possible. The people who best knew fire, the firefighters and the police, were shocked when they heard that this fire had raced all the way into town and was threatening buildings. And from there, what we saw is the entire town trying to leave at once. You had 27,000 people hearing about fire in town and seeing it directly in front of them. All of those people took to the roads. And as you mentioned, Paradise had this plan where, you know, residents could use both lanes of traffic to evacuate in an emergency situation. But if you have tens of thousands of people taking to the roads at the same time, no matter where you are in America, no matter how prepared a town might be, there will be gridlock. And that's ultimately what we saw in Paradise, is people stuck in their cars, desperately trying to flee as things were burning around them.
Alistair, what would you add? And based on the experts you spoke with, what can cities learn about what worked and what didn't work?
Well, I think one of the major problems in Paradise, for instance, was that this emergency alert system was a voluntary sign-up system. And so a lot of people didn't receive alerts. And then very early on, the fire disabled cell towers. It burned cell towers. The lines were overloaded. So of the 27,000 residents, only a handful, a couple thousand, actually received alerts in the first place. And so there clearly needs to be a better kind of alert system. What we also saw in Paradise was that the city actually had an emergency operations center that was meant to gear up in times of fire. And I spoke to the city manager, and she's the city's top administrative official, and she woke up that morning at 7 a.m., saw a fire out the window. It looked like it was far away. She raced into City Hall to set up this emergency operations center, but immediately, because there was no communications, because communications were down, she had no way of getting any kind of situational awareness. And so ultimately, she had to evacuate herself and the emergency operations center down to Chico very quickly. And so I think one of the big lessons of Paradise is that we have to prepare for a town that not only will maybe affect, for instance, one zone or another zone, as happened in Paradise, where they planned, you know, they had this, the city was split into zones, and they thought, oh, it'll affect one zone, it'll affect another zone. We'll have time to set up an emergency operations center. We'll have time to put into place all these excellent plans we have. I think what became clear is that you have to prepare for a fire that can affect every zone at once and that might cut off all of your evacuation routes. And you have to think, well, what will happen then? I spoke to one firefighter. His name was Joe Kennedy, and he was responsible for many acts of heroism on the day. As everyone was driving out of town, he was one of those that was driving into town on his semi with a bulldozer on the back, and he got into his bulldozer and rescued so many people by clearing burning cars out of the way. He in fact rescued a fire truck that was stuck with people inside. The cab was paint was melting off the outside of the fire truck cab. He cleared cars and helped these people get away. He actually lives in the Grass Valley, Nevada City area, just a couple hours southeast of Paradise. And his big lesson from Paradise was actually, you know, along the lines of what I suggested. He thought that, you know, previously he hadn't really thought that a town of of the kind where he lived was vulnerable to the kind of fire that hit Paradise. And his big lesson after being in the middle of the Paradise fire was, hey, wait, this could affect where I live. And in fact, he said to me, I think it is going to affect Grass Valley, Nevada City. It is. It's coming for us. That kind of deadly fire is in our future now, and I now realize that. And so in a way, if anything, the one silver lining of this fire is that it has been a kind of wake-up call and has shown us exactly what is possible.
Right. Well, and to your point, in terms of preparation plans, do you know, are we seeing more robust preparation plans in cities, not even just in California, but really across the West? Do you know, Alistair?
Yeah, I think this has been a big wake-up call. I mean, there was a fantastic USA Today investigation that, in fact, looked at how many cities even had plans in towns that face similar kinds of threats to Paradise. And they found that you know, actually a minority only had decent plans. And so I think that has certainly spurred action. And, you know, what we've seen, for instance, in the rebuilding of Paradise is much more attention to these kinds of issues. The town has created a vision for its rebuilding, and a number of the points were exactly focused on, you know, we need to prioritize vegetation management, we need to prioritize evacuation routes, we need to ensure that all buildings now meet the requirements for buildings that exist in flammable areas. They need to, for instance, have no openings in the homes and better roofing systems so that leaves don't gather in gutters and they're essentially acting as flammable tinder. And so I think you're seeing a rebuilding in Paradise, and I think you're going to see exactly that kind of ethos being applied more broadly now, where people are going to be taking this much more seriously.
Well, before we go to break, let's hear from a caller who has a question about the building of Paradise and whether that was part of the problem. Let's go to Lou in San Francisco. Hi, Lou. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I was just wondering, I thought I had read that there was some kind of a fishy dealing as far as how they subdivided the. I think that Paradise is unincorporated, if I'm not mistaken, and that there was something about how some developers were like putting three trailers or three places on one lot that was supposed to be just for one trailer, and that part of the problem was it was the density was really sort of, everyone was sort of packed into the space, and some of it was maybe not totally legal. I wonder if that was true, is true or not, or I just somehow came up with that.
All right, thanks, yep. Lou. Danny, do you want to take that one?
Sure. So that's definitely something we've heard and seen. Paradise is still incorporated. It still has a town council and a local police department. But I know there have been concerns about developers, you know, coming in and splicing up lots. And I think the concern of the town no longer belonging to people who lived there. I know that's something that's on the mind of residents who stayed, residents who, you know, evacuated to across the country and never returned, is that they ultimately, even if they don't come back, they don't want to see their town turn into something, you know, different than it was. They want Paradise to come back as a small town like it was before, you know, populated by people who live in the area.
And if I could just add as well.
Sure, Alistair.
The town was incorporated relatively recently. I think it was 1979. And so prior to that, certainly, there were a lot of planning irregularities. I spoke to a Butte County planner who worked in Paradise in that period. And she said that absolutely lots were subdivided in very strange ways. You would find trailers or buildings or homes off private driveways. Access was difficult for some of these. Firefighters that we spoke to who worked in the town before the fire said you would drive around and you would find homes, tucked behind homes in all sorts of crazy little spaces and nooks. And so absolutely there had been, in part because of its history being unincorporated for, you know, for many, many decades, there was certainly issues with the way that buildings were situated and very close together on very small lots.
Well, thanks again for the question. We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're speaking with Alistair G. and Danny Anguiano, co-authors of the new book, Fire in Paradise, an American Tragedy. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will discuss Black women and girls and trans women who have been shot and killed by police or have died in police custody. On March 13th, police shot and killed Breonna Taylor as she was sleeping in her home in the early hours of March 13th. The officers have not been arrested or charged. The case is under investigation by the FBI. Breonna Taylor would have turned 27 on June 5th. And then coming up on Wednesday, we'll have a conversation on racial justice. We'll talk about the protests with John Powell, director of the Othering and Belonging at UC Berkeley. And Thursday, we'll find out how the U.S. government's COVID bailout is benefiting Wall Street and corporations. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email us, yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation about fires, we're talking with Alistair G., award-winning journalist and editor of special series at The Guardian, and Danny Anguiano, copy editor at The Guardian, about their new book, Fire in Paradise, an American Tragedy. If you are affected by this fire or any other fires, we'd love to hear from you. What questions or comments do you have? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Let's hear from Paul in San Francisco. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show. Hi, do we have Paul?
Yes.
Hi, Paul. Go ahead.
Hi. I work in Paradise. I'm building a fourplex house there with 100 solar panels. You may know that Senator Scott Wiener is introducing legislation to allow people like me to build multi-unit homes as a way to increase the amount of housing. But by adding 100 solar panels onto these houses, what I'm doing is lowering the cost of housing. And then I'm going one step further, which is trying to get PG&E to pay 49 cents a kilowatt hour for the surplus solar energy sold onto the grid. This will lower the cost of housing. And just like the cost of cell phones dropped over the years due to technology, the solar technology will drop the cost of housing if we build these multi-unit fourplex 100-panel solar-powered houses. So that's what I'm doing in Paradise in order to help recover the town.
Paul, can I ask you, in the past shows we've done about fires, especially around Santa Rosa, which was in town, there were so many questions around rebuilding and whether it should happen and what that should look like. I mean, I'm sure that you and other community members have had long conversations about this. How are you thinking about this issue?
Well, rebuilding is important, but it needs to be done in a safer way than it was done in the past, and it has to be done in a way that is sustainable, of building of sustainable housing, I think is one of the major goals of the housing community in the state of California now, because we have so much sun here. And even towns like Paradise, enough sun falls on Paradise in 1 hour to run the whole city for 1 year if we can capture it with solar panels and batteries. And that was in the movie An Inconvenient Truth by Al Gore. He pointed out that fact, that most towns, especially in California, get enough solar energy in 1 hour to run the whole city for a whole year if we just do this thing right. And so I see Paradise as a city that can be rebuilt along that way. Any of these destroyed cities could be. That's why Scott Wiener's bill is so important for empowering people that own the land to build fourplex houses.
Well, thank you for calling in. Let's talk about rebuilding. In your book, you write that by the fall of 2019, the town of Paradise issued about 250 rebuild permits. And in the blueprint, there are several issues related to fire safety, a better alert system, better evacuation routes, more brush trimming. Danny, what did experts tell you about what needs to happen in order to rebuild Paradise?
Well, one of the things to keep in mind is the housing stock that existed in Paradise at the time of the fire was quite old. It wasn't up to modern standards. So that's certainly one of the things that they thought would actually help, you know, that these new homes could be built up to current standards, you know, in a way that they're more likely to survive a fire than those older homes are. And there's also been a lot of talks about, you know, mobile home parks and whether those should exist in Paradise and how they should exist. Because as we know, what happened in Paradise, that, you know, where multiple mobile home parks just completely burned up because one trailer was set fire to the next. The housing there was all quite close. So I think from what I've heard, people are optimistic about rebuilding Paradise in a way to ensure that this doesn't happen again. And the other thing to keep in mind for, you know, for me in addressing the question of whether Paradise should be rebuilt, and this is echoed by some of the experts I spoke with, is that people are going to live where they're going to live, and the best thing we can do is empower them to live there safely.
What would you add, Alistair?
Well, I think to Danny's point, and as you said, part of the reason Paradise was so attractive was precisely because it was so affordable. And so, you know, the question of whether or not people should live in Paradise or indeed places like it is a little bit moot when you consider that some people were forced to live there because they couldn't afford to live anywhere else. I remember one victim I wrote about, and his name was Ernie Foss, and he used to live in the Haight in San Francisco. He was born in the city and worked in a gemstone store in the Haight, and he was like a classic San Francisco Summer of Love type, and he was forced out because of his disability and because of rising prices, first to Hayward and then to you know, far north in California and eventually to Paradise. And the reason he ended up in Paradise, he loved it there, but the reason he ended up there was an economic equation for him. It was simply the place that he could afford to live. And I think that's really something to bear in mind when we talk about should people be living here. It's also important to ask, well, is the reason people are here because they've been priced out of other places? I think that's such an important part of the equation. Often people don't have a choice in where they live. And so I think we have to approach the question also through the lens of inequality as well.
Right. And what have you heard from experts about what will happen once Paradise is rebuilt? Will it still be an affordable community? Will people still be able to buy a two-bedroom for $200,000?
I think
one of the things
Paradise had a lot of what experts call naturally occurring affordable housing, and that was because it was old, because it was closer, it was the lots were small, and so the expectation is that with a lot of that wiped out, you know, Paradise lost 14,000 homes, that lost over 90% of its structures. And so because a lot of the rebuilding that's happening now is up to a higher standard, the expectation is that it will be less affordable. In fact, we've seen this sort of thing happen after other natural disasters. After Hurricane Katrina, for instance, in some of the most badly damaged neighborhoods, they were the ones that gentrified the quickest after, because there was a lot of investment in rebuilding the infrastructure, the public infrastructure. And so then private developers were able to come in and take advantage of that and build nicer housing, essentially. And so I don't think there's any sort of anything nefarious happening in Paradise. It's just a natural product of the fact that because you have a lot of rebuilding and because it's going to be expensive, the housing itself will be more expensive. And so I think perhaps that character of the town, where it was a kind of refuge, it may be lost in the future.
And Dana, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah. So immediately after the fire in the early days, I talked to this disaster expert who studies, you know, how communities around the world have rebuilt after various disasters, whether it's a typhoon or an earthquake. And the first thing he told me was that Paradise will be a different place, that the people who are most vulnerable, you know, they won't be able to wait for the town to rebuild. They have to try to, you know, move on with their lives in the best way that they can. And so that Paradise will likely be a different, smaller, more expensive community.
And as you report in your book, only 15% of the original population still lives in Paradise. So many people are living in other states as far away as Florida. Right, Dani?
That's exactly right. So, you know, just a few thousand people have returned. Some returned to the few homes that survived. Some, you know, were camping in RVs and tents on their burnt-up properties. And a few homes have been rebuilt, but most people have spread out primarily in the immediate area in Butte County, but also, you know, all over the country and all over the world. One woman I know whose family had lived in that area for, you know, decades, for about 70 years, she lost her home, she lost her father, and this home was this, you know, this historic old cabin that was about 100 years old. And she really wants to stay in the area. So right now she is in FEMA housing about 40 miles away, really hoping that, you know, she'll be able to rebuild her life sometime soon.
Well, thanks again for the call, Lou. Let's go next to David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Rose. Yeah, I wanted to ask your guests if they covered any of the water issues up there. You remember the old movie Chinatown that talked about water theft from the mountains and all sold to L.A.? Well, that movie came out almost 50 years ago, and the water theft has just continued. So I'm wondering if you've dealt with that issue in your piece. And then I guess as well, since the state is allowing this water to be sold, it's putting on itself a huge liability. So I personally support the idea of the state taking over PG&E, and if you've covered any of the insurance issues of this water theft plus the liability held by the state as opposed to a private corporation.
All right, thank you for that. Dani, do you want to take that one first?
We've covered some of the various water issues, you know, in the area. The big one that comes to mind, though, is actually about the water system being, you know, damaged by the fire. That's been the most pressing water issue in Paradise since the fire. And basically what happened is the water system was so badly damaged by the fire that the water there was basically, you know, not drinkable. People couldn't use it to drink or to shower. And so I think the community has been really, really focused on that. But the other element of it, and I know this is a little bit different than what the caller was addressing, is there was a canal that people in the area relied on, that, you know, local ranches in the area relied on. Their water was, you know, their access to water was completely eliminated. And so now PG&E, you know, made an agreement, a multi-million-dollar agreement to supply them with water for the coming years.
Anything to add, Alistair?
Yeah, the caller raised the question of liability in PG&E, and that's a fascinating topic, and it's a drama that's still unfolding. Early on, it became very clear that it was a PG&E tower that had sparked the blaze, and there were some astonishing revelations. The Wall Street Journal did a story revealing that the tower was actually a candidate, or at least the line the tower was on was a candidate for inclusion in the National Register of Historic Places. That's how old it was. It was, in fact, 99 years old on the day of the fire. That power line is called the Caribou Palermo power line. The system has actually been decommissioned now since the fire, but the question of PG&E's liability is not going to go away. It accepted responsibility for 84 counts of manslaughter, and it settled with the town and the county for hundreds of millions of dollars, and that's still in process right now. But there is, of course, a broader question for all of California, which is that PG&E is responsible for many, many disasters. There is, of course, the San Bruno pipeline explosion, and there are many, many other wildfires that its equipment has been implicated in. And so the question is, what do we do about PG&E, this investor-owned utility? It appears to have these dual or perhaps even conflicting responsibilities. One is to deliver good returns to its shareholders. The other is to maintain and invest in its safety and ensure that its equipment isn't aging, that it is up to the highest standards. And so people like Ken Pimlock, who is the former head of CAL FIRE and was the head of CAL FIRE at the time of the Paradise Fire, said, you have here perhaps an irreconcilable conflict between a company that has to both deliver profit and also invest as much as it possibly can in safety. And how do we know it's investing as much as it can in safety when it's expected to deliver profits as well? And so I don't think that's a question that's going to go away anytime soon.
Right. And we are even expecting power shutoffs again this year. This is, you know, receiving a lot of attention. And then just recently, Governor Gavin Newsom said that the California PUC is creating a 106-person safety division to monitor the state's investor-owned utilities to ensure they abide by requirements to modernize their systems and transmission lines to reduce the risk of igniting a wildfire. I'm just reading from the LA Times here. Alistair, can you give us a quick update? Modernizing these systems and transmission lines to reduce even more wildfires. What is the status of that, and what would that involve? How long would that take?
Well, it's a massive process. PG&E, in addition to its tens of thousands of miles of gas lines, that have over 100,000 miles of power lines. And I remember speaking with a former regulator, a former member of the PUC, and he told me that there's this theory of organizations, but some organizations are so complicated that no one person can understand it. And he said, I put PG&E squarely in that category. We saw at the time of the San Bruno explosion that the plans that it had for that particular pipeline, they were out of date. They didn't accurately show that pipeline. And as with the power lines that started the Paradise Fire, again, some of them were so old that PG&E itself had said these should have been replaced years ago. They were decades past their life. And so that's the issue that's now facing PG&E. Not only does it have this aging infrastructure, it also has to maintain vegetation clearance around those lines. So there's a concern around, well, if a tree falls on a power line or there's vegetation underneath the power line, if there's an outage, that can spark a fire. So PG&E has several thousand vegetation maintenance workers who are out there ensuring that there is clearance around PG&E's lines. Now, PG&E says that it can't possibly do the work that is required of it. It said that it would take more staff, more vegetation managers than are available in the whole of the U.S. to maintain the standards that have been asked of it. And so it seems like without, I don't know, massively raising rates or some other solution, PG&E is saying that we can't possibly keep or maintain the standards that are necessary. And so to my mind, that's a concern. Mm.
Well, we'll definitely do a show about this because I think it really does require an entire hour to get an update on what that would involve. Thank you for the call. We have an email from Henry. This is really important, talking about the public health issues around this. He writes, I don't mean in any way to compare what I and people like me went through to the suffering of the people of Paradise and other directly affected areas, but it is worth noting that blown smoke has a devastating effect on some people. I have asthma and a history of respiratory illness. The first night of the campfire was far and away the worst of my life. I really thought I was going to die, even though I live pretty far away in Berkeley and have air purifiers. I really think I might not have survived if my kids hadn't dragged me up to South Lake Tahoe, which at that point was clear. I have no idea how many other people are as sensitive to smoke, but I'm sure I'm not alone. Thank you for this, Henry. It's such an important point, Danny, because whenever these fires happen in California, people far, far away are really affected by the smoke. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, if it's this bad here in San Francisco in the East Bay, what is it like in Paradise and the surrounding areas?
Right. Well, I'm sorry to hear that, Henry. You know, I think it is a public health concern and everyone is affected by it, but particularly those, you know, with ongoing respiratory issues. I remember that day. The day that the fire started, I was at the Guardian office in Oakland. And, you know, as I'm talking to, you know, my family who are worried about this fire, I start to smell smoke. And I thought, no, that couldn't be smoke from this fire. And sure enough, it was. And, you know, the smoke completely covered the Bay Area. Some reports said that it went as far as New York, that people were seeing it there. So it absolutely is, you know, a major public health concern. It's something that academics and scientists are studying now to try to learn about the effects of smoke on the public. I know there's been some studies around the effect of smoke on pregnant women. But there was also, you know, just shockingly severe. I remember my chest hurt for weeks afterward. And that thick layer of smoke just hung over the area. You know, everyone was having trouble breathing. Some of the people I talked to in Paradise who were there when the fire started were actually hospitalized for several weeks because, you know, the smoke severely damaged their lungs.
Well, gosh, Henry, what a story. This just sounds horrible. And I'm glad your kids dragged you up to South Lake Tahoe, which at that point was clear. Again, another really important show idea. We'll talk about how fire affects our health. And, you know, given that this is going to continue happening, in fact, Governor Newsom said there's been a 60% increase in fires from January to May 10th compared with the same period last year. This is going to continue affecting us. So we'll definitely do a show about that. Thank you for writing in, Henry. I want to spend our final minutes talking about the indigenous people who were in what is now Paradise. And I really appreciate you both writing about this because it is so important. As you write in your book, 310,000 people were speaking hundreds of languages in the area prior to European colonization. And they managed California extensively, pruning trees and shrubs, irrigating and watering the land, setting fires to promote new growth of preferred plants, to clear the terrain and make hunting easier, and to lessen the threat of big fires. Alistair, can you briefly just tell us about that and what you learned?
Yeah, well, it's interesting that the caller mentioned his terrible experiences with smoke. In fact, prior to European colonization, California may have spent much of the summer and the fall under a blanket of smoke, in part because wildfire is a natural part of the landscape and lightning-lit fires were common, and also because native people did use fire as a management tool. They used it to clear certain, for instance, land, fields and grasslands that they wanted to keep clear for hunting purposes, and so on. And so actually, California was extensively managed prior to European settlement, and as much as 5 million of California's 105 million acres may have burned every year. And so, in fact, in the Paradise area, there was a native population prior to the Gold Rush, when European people and Americans started to arrive there, and these people were unfortunately essentially wiped out during the Gold Rush, not only because of diseases that settlers brought in with them, but also because there was simple brutal violence directed at the Native American residents there. And in fact, the U.S. made a treaty with the residents of that area and other parts of California that would have given the native people in that area control of the area that in fact became Paradise. But unfortunately, that treaty was never ratified. And today there are several organizations of Native Americans in the area, several rancherias. But the population of that area was essentially completely almost completely eradicated.
You write that the ridge and the surrounding areas were home to the Konkau, part of a tribal group of about 9,000 people. And when the United States broke that treaty, survivors were marched to a reservation over 100 miles away where a Konkau leader reported that his people starved. And that journey, in which at least 32 of the 461 unwilling marchers died along the way and only 277 reached their destination, that has become known as the Konkau Trail of Tears.
Yeah, absolutely. The Konkau, they were the people who lived in the area. In fact, a town called Konkau is named after them. And it was estimated that of the perhaps over 10,000 native people that lived in that area, only 1,000 remained after European Euro-American colonization. And so, yeah, the people and their language and their culture and their history, they were essentially eradicated. And in fact, on the ridge, Paradise Ridge today, there are still some remnants of these people. There are areas that were thought to have been used for grinding grain and so on. And I don't mean to say that, you know, that these people were completely eradicated. As I mentioned, there are local cultural organizations of their descendants. And so native life does continue in the region, but it is unfortunately much diminished from what it was. One of my most memorable experiences on the ridge was getting a tour from a professor of flora. He's a botanist, and he's an expert in the natural landscape. And his grandparents were Native American, and it was wonderful to be with him and just see the landscape through his eyes.
Well, it's so important to know this history, especially right now. So again, thank you so much for including that in your very important book. Alistair G. is an editor of special series at The Guardian. Danny Anguiano is a copy editor at The Guardian, and they are co-authors of the new book, Fire in Paradise, an American Tragedy. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.